Social media, unfortunately, has no end. So anxiety is this rumination in a single thought, right? We're on it for hours, days. I mean, it's absurd how long we stay ruminative.
Hey everyone, Nathan Long here, president of Saybrook University, located here in Pasadena, California. Welcome to another episode of Saybrook Insights. My guest today is the incredible, amazing Dr. Donna Rockwell, who's on Saybrook University's faculty. In addition to her having a wealth of experience, including as a supporting founder of CNN way back in the day, she is on adjunct faculty here at the university in the College of Integrative Medicine and Health Sciences, the Department of Mind-Body Medicine, and serves and has served as an adjunct faculty representative of the Saybrook Faculty Senate. Donna is the founder and CEO of Already Famous with Dr. Donna, a movement and online community inspiring women and girls to live their best, most authentic lives through developing self-confidence, inner worth, and purpose or meaning in life. She's a licensed clinical psychologist with private practices in both New York and Michigan. And Donna is a leading mindfulness meditation teacher, researcher, and faculty member, specialist in celebrity mental health, and activist in contemporary humanistic psychology. I think it bears mentioning that she's also been at the vanguard, the front of really highlighting the important contributions of women in psychology, specifically humanistic psychology, but also psychology at large. With 20 years of experience, Dr. Donna is a mental health expert featured on TV, radio, and social media. I think you'll be excited to also hear she's going to be on TMZ potentially here in the future. So some current opportunities coming up. And her research on the psychology of fame and celebrity has been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Newsweek, the Atlantic, the BBC, the CBC, among other media outlets. We are in the face of, in the shadow of greatness here with Dr. Donna Rockwell, and this interview was a pleasure. So let's get to it with Dr. Donna Rockwell. Dr. Donna Rockwell, it is truly a pleasure to have the myth, the legend, and now in person, one of our great faculty members. I consider you a friend, a colleague, and most importantly, all the great things that you're doing out there have just, they're so impressive, and I can't wait to hear about those today, as our audience, I know, will be excited to hear about. Before we get into all the meat of what you are doing out there, maybe what you could start off with is a simple but very important piece around your background, how you found yourself starting in media, which I think is important, and then your evolution into academia and becoming this great clinician that you are.
Well, speaking to the president of Saybrook University, I will say that my journey began actually, I would say, at Hampshire College, where I am a proud alumni. And Hampshire had a beautiful way, reminds me of Saybrook, in that we're looking for the deeper meanings in life. At Saybrook, Hampshire, the slogan was, to know is not enough. And that's the same edict that we live by at Saybrook, where we go deeper to understand the true lived experience of the human being. And through there, we can heal one another. It's a mutual journey. So I went to Hampshire College. I wanted to be a doctor. I didn't do so well at chemistry because I actually grew up in Barbados. I went to high school in Barbados, and chemistry was not one of our top subjects. I took domestic science and domestic science theory. So I learned all about nutrition, which is actually interesting.
Very good, though.
Because they cared about women being able to take care of their children and know what was healthy. So, yep. And I took chemistry at Hampshire. It's the five college system. So you have Hampshire, Mount Holyoke, Smith, Amherst and the University of Mass Amherst. So I took chemistry at UMass Amherst and I did not do well. And I had to drop out of the pre-med program. So I ended up going into radio and television because Ken Burns was one of my classmates.
Oh my.
Incredible documentary maker. Yeah. And I have a little third pierced hole in my ear over here, and his wife to be actually pierced my ear at Hampshire. So I came into television through this way, through documentary making. I did my final projects on television. I took a camera to Washington, D.C. and talked my way into the White House, Jimmy Carter's White House. I was on the South Lawn with my little reel-to-reel with all the networks, and they're like, where did you come from? But I used my college media pass to get into the White House, and it worked. That was before 9/11. But anyway, so I just had this wonderful experience in media. And then, flash ahead, I got my master's in journalism. I went on to work for CNN. And then I became a mom. And I was really invested in being a television producer of other sorts, of producing my children, is what it felt like. So I produced for Daniel Shore at CNN, where I started in 1980 and helped start that network. I became the Capitol Hill producer, covering both the House and the Senate for CNN with my excellent reporting colleagues. And yeah, it was a wonderful, I learned so much. You know, I learned that in order to get, for senators and congressmen to get to the floor of the House or Senate, they have to pass through a sea of lobbyists. And that when I saw that that is how government works and the influence of these sort of outsized financial constraints on democracy or the people actually getting what is their due in our society, that this influence was so heavy. So I've used every section of my life to kind of learn how the whole thing works.
Well, and I think before you go on, I think just to hit on that point, I mean, we hear about it, but for you to see it up close in action probably was an entirely different, almost kind of, I don't know if we call it horrifying, but enlightening. We'll go with the best word possible, enlightening experience to see how that passage through lobbyists into the well of the Senate and the House is that journey there. And I'm sure, how did you find yourself responding to that just as a citizen? I mean, were you, I don't know, what came up for you in that moment or in those moments?
What came up for me was the whole reason anyone would become a journalist, which is to represent the Fourth Estate, which is the people's right to know, and to push back against the power of lobbies, to push back against that and to get the critical information to the people so that they can decide who they want their leaders to be. So it just more entrenched my dedication, not only to the Fourth Estate, to the people's right to know, not only to the spirit of Norma Rae, but also when I got to Saybrook, I was the adjunct faculty rep on Faculty Senate for the same reason, because the people need representation. As you know, I mean, Saybrook is so incredible in embracing diversity and understanding the innovative value that we're missing by not embracing each and every one of us, that we need to be the change we want to see. Saybrook represents that, and I think journalists, even with the bad rep that media gets today, is imperative for democracy. We are telling the story so the people know. Did you know that lobbying influences everything that happens? Who gets the money? Who gets covered? Where the support of government funds go to, and who gets cut out of that, you know, our marginalized populations. So the whole thing was just an eye opener. And then I ended up becoming a doctor. How did that ever happen? Because I stayed home with my children for several years while I was taking literary journalism classes at the University of Michigan, just to sort of stay involved. I would tell my kids, they had their babysitter then, and I'd say, I'll be back in two Care Bears. Two Care Bears, because they knew what the, how much time that was. And then I just, started teaching meditation because I was very much into mindfulness. I'm a mindfulness teacher, to therapists in Royal Oak, Michigan. And they said, there's an amazing school. It's called the Center for Humanistic Studies. And I think you'd love it there. So that's what happened. I fell in love. I felt like it was Brigadoon. Like every 100 years, the city lands. This amazing school, like Saybrook, landed and was there for me. I was like, was this school created just for me? Because I could study things that were so interesting to me. You know, at Saybrook too, we can pick our dissertation topic. The adjunct faculty member from England, who was on my dissertation committee, said he had to do his dissertation on childhood spelling, because that's what was needed at that time. He couldn't do something that was actually interesting to him. So to be able to do research in our passion area is really a gift. And so it came full circle, and here I am, being a doctor.
How did you land at Saybrook? I want to get to your journey of post-grad, but you ended up at Saybrook. How did you find us?
As faculty, well, I created a curriculum at the Michigan School of Professional Psychology, which is now the Michigan School, which is where I had gone to school for my master's and doctorate, originally called the Center for Humanistic Studies. And Clark Moustakas, who's one of the founders of humanistic psychology, was my mentor. He was my teacher. I took childhood psychology with him, play therapy. I took existential dream analysis. I took phenomenological research study, heuristic research study. He came up with the heuristic model, which is studying our own experience in the world to see how others may have had the same experience or not of ours, and to really look into that lived world. And so there was a job opening at Saybrook after I left the Michigan school. And by word of mouth, someone said, they need a mindfulness teacher. And I said, do I have a mindfulness teacher for them?
Yeah, that's right.
So that was me. And I came having already created curriculum, done research studies on mindfulness that is published in book chapters and in articles. On the effect of mindfulness training on doctoral students in clinical psychology, how important it is for practitioners to have a mindful center from which they work.
Yeah, that's great. And we've been the beneficiaries of that for many years now with you being here. It's been fabulous. And I know your mentorship has meant a lot to the students, and I know your colleagueship has been great for our students. And you've been doing a lot as a clinician and as a researcher and as a leader in psychology. So I've got some more pointed questions around your work with kids and in the wellness space. But before we do that, I think our audience needs to know just how vast your work has been in different areas of practice, research, and in psychology leadership. So maybe give us a taste of what you've been up to. And full disclosure, Donna and I had the opportunity, so I'm talking to the audience here, right, of me seeing her give her presidential address at the APA National Convention, and also honoring our founder, Dr. Eleanor Criswell. And it was then that I really saw you in a whole different light. And so I kind of maybe stepped on your lead there, but maybe give us a taste of what you've been up to over these years in those spaces.
I'd love to know what the different light was.
A very positive one, let's say that.
I see. Well, so I was elected president of Division 32 of the American Psychological Association, which is humanistic psychology. And one thing I found was, in a sort of patriarchal sense, within the psychological and psychiatric world that women hadn't really been given their due. So if we have certain things we can accomplish during that 1 year, and one thing I wanted to accomplish was creating a ward honoring, celebrating women in humanistic psychology, whose names are not on awards, whose names are not on plaques on walls. Marie Curie, Madame Curie, the only reason she was able to get her awards that she did, her prizes in science and chemistry, was because a man spoke up for her, an ally. Without that, we would never have known of her name. And by the way, I wrote my college essay on her, wanting to be like Madame Curie.
That's so cool.
Aside from the radiation part.
Right.
But, you know, when we step into the therapy room with people, we have to be willing to sit in their pain with them. And it's a honed skill, and it's an important skill, which is why mindfulness is critical for practitioners who are sitting in the room in sacred space with another person, to be able to come from that quieted spot where wisdom grows, where wisdom is born. So that's where most of my work is. So I created a ward that year celebrating women in humanistic psychology, and I honored one of the greatest women in humanistic psychology who you fell in love with.
The moment I met her.
A few minutes after myself. So did I. I was at San Francisco State University, and I met her there at a Division 32 conference, and I saw her just like you. I imagine it's the same thing. I completely fell in love. Like, my mouth was hanging open, and I interviewed her. It's on SHPTV, Society for Humanistic Psychology TV on YouTube, which I also started bringing media into our psychological world. So there's a whole storehouse of videos there, and the interview with her is there. And I just decided to name the award after her because she deserved it. She came up with somatic approaches to psychotherapy. She understands that, to quote another person's work, the body keeps the score.
Love that book. Thank you for bringing that up. Yes.
She allowed the science to move in that direction and was the founder of the original Saybrook University when it was a research institute. So my goodness, right? And it's just been a pleasure to watch her blossom even in her later years, you know, in her third, I call it third chapter bliss. And thank you too for creating a scholarship in her name to further honor her and the roots of humanistic psychology, which cares so much about the heart and soul of a person, about their actual lived experience, and sees it as sacred.
Well, I appreciate that. I think the, you know, not to make this a big love fest with Donna Rockwell, but I think that would not have happened in the way it did had you not done that in that moment, in that space when I was there, because we had talked at the university about bringing in our founders, and she was right there in that moment. And it just seemed like such an obvious opportunity. But I think the other piece, here for me, and you and I had this, I don't know if you recall, but we had this conversation before you took on the presidency around the mythologies that we've created, I think, not just in psychology, but I think societally, but I think at the time we were really focused on psychology, about the very thing you're talking about, right? That there were, you know, these two or three men that came together to form this university or this, you know, the humanistic psychology piece. When you dig in the history, as you rightly pointed out, I think in your remarks and in later conversations, there were so many women that were integral. And Eleanor Criswell, of course, is at the pinnacle of that group, that were so vital to the, not only the founding, but the sustaining of humanistic psychology and psychology at large as a discipline, and really pushing it forward and out of the space of the, not out of, but kind of into and being understood as a more inclusive place for women and marginalized groups to really find different voice and space for healing and well-being. So a lot of hats off to you for having the vision to propel that forward out of Division 32, because I think that continued to spider out into the larger discipline. So,
and that was part of my presidential theme. Like, how stupid are we to bypass the brilliance and innovation from diverse thinking?
That's right.
Come on, people. You know, it's like, it doesn't take a brain science to realize that the more we put into the pot, the richer will be the stew.
That's right.
And we need to honor one another. You know, I've been talking a lot, as you know, I'm a mental health communicator, expert, they say, on television and radio. And I've been talking a lot about this isolation epidemic in America, as the Surgeon General has spoken about recently. You know, it's a crisis, this loneliness, this isolation. So we're going to have to find a way to come back together, because you're probably going to start talking about Already Famous soon, but we're really losing our girls and our young boys to the influence of social media, and they're losing themselves. And my concern and fear is we're losing an entire generation of brilliance to this.
It's a perfect segue, and then maybe we can circle back to some of your current work in the space of Already Famous and other activities that you've been engaged in. You know, you're absolutely 100% right. We've been having these conversations nationally at homes. We just had this recently. My daughter came to visit with her girlfriend, and we were talking about the influence of social media. Yes, it's probably going to wane at some point as the newest thing comes into play, but it is still the location, the place, the space for people to congregate, to convene, to engage. And I think your emphasis around both general mental health, but specifically kids' mental health, has been so important for us to consider. Can you talk about, you know, what is the actual challenge before us? And then maybe talk to how can parents help out with their kids' mental health in this social media age? So looking at the bigger picture of what's happening from your perspective, what you're seeing, and then how parents can start working with their kids and maybe even each other, right? And their colleagues and their friends in that space. So,
first of all, the problem with social media is the scrolling. The brain needs to start a task, complete the task. We are going to start this podcast and we will complete this podcast. That's what the brain needs. Social media, unfortunately, has no end. So anxiety is this rumination in a single thought, right? We're on it for hours, days. I mean, it's absurd how long we stay ruminative in this loop. It's an addiction and it's a bad habit. That's why mindfulness can eradicate that. But on social media, with especially young people, they're scrolling and scrolling, so their brains feel anxiety because they can't complete a task. They scroll from this to this to this to this. So there's no rest for the mind. There's no rest for the brain. That's the number one problem. So that's what's happening physiologically. And now the attention span, I think, it went from 8 to 3 seconds. I mean, it's really short. If you look on Instagram, you'll see that the videos are cut because attention spans are getting shorter and shorter.
Well, right. And we were just talking about that, right, with the intro. This is why, right, we try to keep this to 30 to 45 minutes. Even then, that's too long, right? Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking you mean 8 seconds, right? So when you said that. So, yeah. So, and the other problem is that I like to call it, what's good for the gander is good for the goose. It's like we have all these mothers telling their daughters to stay off of social media while they're on social media, you know? So what's good for the goose is good for the gander. It's also true mothers have to model for their daughters how they want their daughters to turn out. And children are not appendages or like charms on a charm bracelet. They are students sitting at the knee of us, learning and absorbing and taking in. So to answer your question, we need to realize that our one job is to successfully launch these offspring we've brought into the world. And our job is to let them know that we are on Team Susan, whatever her name is, or his name. I am on your side. I have two boys, they're in their mid-30s, and when they were growing up, that's what I would tell them. I'd say, I'm on your side. You know, this is not an opposition to you. I'm doing this because I'm on your side. One time my son said to me, I think he was 7 or 8, and he didn't like something I said to him, and he said, I hate you. And I said, you'll have days like that. Because I remembered I had days like that.
Yeah.
So for sure. What did he get? He remembers it now. He's 36. He remembers when I said that. Because I didn't react. I didn't get angry at him. I didn't have an ego in the game. I was on Team Zach. And so I think that's the most important piece. The relationship we create with our children, that they know that we are there for them, that we monitor their social media use because we're in a new universe. And the same way we monitor their oral hygiene by making sure they brush their teeth every night, we need to have social media hygiene and put the phones away when we come to the dinner table. And for goodness sakes, have a dinner table. I worked at Common Ground Sanctuary during my internship, which is a runaway shelter for teens in Michigan. And there was a woman there, her name was Barb, and she had a dinner table. And it was the first time a lot of any of these kids had sat at a dinner table and understood the value of dinner table time. And they now are off into the world creating their own dinner tables. We have to do the same for our own children. And we need to help them understand the value of this connection. That's what the Surgeon General has found, is that we're lacking connection. We used to be able to go to our neighbor and say, hey, can I borrow a cup of sugar? Not so easy anymore. So it has to start at home. We have to work on these relationships in our own house, and then they can go out into the community. And then I think Saybrook's big on this too. We have to create communities that can be copacetic. They can work as a nurturing center for human beings, like being able to walk to work, being able to ride your bike to the grocery store, having a town center where there's music and the children and the families come together. This is how we can heal as a nation, not by staying siloed. And it begins in the house, and it begins in that relationship. And understanding we're modeling for them everything we do.
What would you say, though, to the... There would be critics of your point of view.
Tell me.
Yeah, that would argue or that would say, hey, we're evolving as a species. And so that all sounds really great, but, you know, kids these days or young adults will say, Dr. Donna, fabulous, but this is how I engage with my peer group. This is how I network. It's how I get my jobs. It's how I go to work. It's what I do for work. These are all things that are part of who I am. And in fact, social media is wired into who we are globally. And as a human species, that could be an argument. And I've heard that come from younger people, you know, that say that.
I think it's true. I think it's very true, number one. And number two, we're not talking about all social media. We're talking about this part of social media. Social media is a gathering place for young people, you know, marginalized people in communities, LGBTQ people have found each other there. And oh my gosh, it's so rich. It's wonderful. This is not about the meeting place. This is how we hold the meeting place. It's not losing our personal connection to the meeting place. And this parent-child relationship, I think, is the core of everything. And parents need to understand that adolescents are going to push back. They're going to want to individuate because that's normal and natural. I also think there needs to be an education so that parents can understand what to expect. You know, your daughter doesn't hate you. She's becoming her own woman. Can you hold, you know, in a humanistic psychology sense, can you hold that space for her? Can you not make this about you? Right? It takes a lot of stamina and patience and insight and educating ourselves about what good parenting really looks like. It's not easy, this empathy thing.
You bring up such an important point around the humanistic ethos, right? About we've had it described at Saybrook as sitting in the fire with an individual, right? But it's you're not it's not about you in that moment. It's about them, the community. It's about the they thou, right? The really hearing and listening and being part of that interconnection with the other human being who's across from you or at the table, as you say. I think you put that beautifully.
It's modeled in the parent-child relationship. And so, you know, that's where my efforts are these days.
That's great. Let me ask you also, it was interesting on my way into the office today, I was talking to my wife and Kim and I said, oh, Kim, I'm getting a chance to talk to Donna today. I'm so excited. And we talked a little bit about the social media piece and the evolution of things around specifically, she has several friends of hers and their children who've had an increase in ADHD diagnoses. And we were talking about social media and particularly, as you noted, the scrolling, right? We'll do the sample. Yeah, the endless doom scrolling or however you want to put it. And I guess from your perspective as a psychologist, I know this may be a little bit further afield, but I think it's right in your zone. Do you see that also as a byproduct of this situation? What are we talking about that more concretely in medical and psychological spaces around ADHD and attention span issues? I think you mentioned it earlier. So
yeah, we totally are. And you're right in what you were saying before, in that the human brain is evolving. And I'm sure we have a different brain than my grandmother did. She was so excited to tell me what it was like when they switched from the gas light to the light bulb. I mean, this was my grandmother. It wasn't that long ago. So our brains are just evolving. Oh, the horseless carriage also was a big deal. And it wasn't that long ago. We forget. We think our time is the only time. But we are in a lineage of all of the people who have come before us and just marking a spot for all the people who will come to be. So it would be good to have respect for that part in our lineage. But attention, our brains are going to change. And for Saybrook and other teaching institutions, teaching will have to change because we're going to lose students more quickly. So I think teaching styles will evolve. We'll use more videos. We'll use more interactive methods of keeping them engaged. There'll be, you know, what's interesting is when we do these teachings with students, the thing they love the most, as far as the kids love the social media today, they love the breakout rooms because they get to be with each other. And I'm always amazed when they come back from the breakout rooms, how enriched they all are. Why? Because they've connected. This loneliness has been solved in the breakout room because they've been able to connect with a cohort peer, a fellow human being. And so, yes, we will have to change our teaching styles. And maybe, I don't know, I'm just dreaming here, but when my kids were in school, the line for the Ritalin outside the nurse's office, like it had to zigzag because there were so many people in it. And so I'm hoping that on some level, the fact that everybody has attention deficit disorder will make it more generalizable and we'll have more solutions for it because we're all going to be suffering from it.
Yeah. Besides, I mean, it's the, you know, like as Kim and I were talking about this morning, there's a huge dialogue going on within her community, her online social media community, around medication or mind-body techniques to support these individuals who are diagnosed with ADHD. And I know that's a little off of what you were just talking about, but I think it's connected in the sense that I think folks are also saying, hey, we are evolving, we are changing, our attention spans are adjusting. And there are ways, as you mentioned just earlier, around the mindfulness techniques and approaches. How do we do this where drugs may not be the first recourse? You may need to be on medication, but there's an opportunity here to say, recenter, to ground oneself in a different way and to see how that might work. And in fact, it was fascinating, kind of right at the heart of what you're talking about. This mom and her child were both diagnosed ADHD, and they're trying out a whole different approach to
collaborative
approach, groundedness that may not include drugs right away. You know, so I don't know. I mean, I think there's some there to that.
Yes. And perhaps, you know, Goldie Hawn, she's a very lovely actress or actor in your wife's field. And so Goldie Hawn started what's called the Mind Up program, and it teaches children in schools mindfulness skills. In other words, just for example, Buddhist psychology says our five senses, they call them sense gates. Now realize we've come up with this wisdom 3,000 years ago. So all of what our interface with life itself are our senses. We don't recognize the coffee we're drinking. We can't hear the birds. We can't, you know, feel our lover's hand in ours because we're thinking about what we have to do at work. We are just not present. So Goldie Hawn and Mind Up and many, many other mindfulness in schools. There are so many programs now that are introducing children to mindfulness techniques so that they can grow up better off than we are right now. They'll understand their central nervous system. They'll understand their fight or flight response and know how to mitigate that. You know, we are having meltdowns because the light isn't turning green fast enough when we're running a little late for a meeting, when that reaction was meant for a lion in the jungle. And we are pumping cortisol with every red light we're freaking out through into our bodies, creating cardiovascular disease, stroke, hypertension, cancers. This is the stress response. This is how we're killing ourselves. So mindfulness, yes. And they're starting to teach it in schools. Goldie Hawn, check out her Mind Up program. It's called the Hawn Foundation. Incredible work in this field. The UK had her come over to London to help them organize how they were going to teach it in schools. It's fantastic. And many other organizations. So I was working with an 8-year-old girl in New York at one time, a few years ago, and I started to draw the brain for her. And I said, this is the amygdala in the back with the fight or flight response. And up here, and she said, I know, that's the PFC. And I said, how do you know that's the prefrontal cortex? And she said, they teach us at school. So I think things are changing.
That's pretty awesome.
You can tell Kim.
I will tell Kim. And we'll have much more discussion tonight, I'm sure, about that. That's really terrific. You know, with social media and all that you've been talking about around attention and mindfulness and how we address that within families, with children in particular, the other dark side or the other multifaceted sides to this, but the one side to this is online bullying, cyberbullying that we've also seen. We've heard many tragic tales over the last many years since social media has emerged in that space. And, you know, as you have noted to me, new research is showing that online bullying is now responsible now for poor mental health and in-person bullying. How do we deal with this? What is the way in which we can, you know, kind of work with kids to manage that not get hurt or mitigate the hurt that comes from this cyber or online bullying? And some other thoughts maybe for parents as they try and work with their kids.
That is why I started this online program called Already Famous with Dr. Donna. And my doctoral research was on the psychology of fame and celebrity. Because I used to work at CNN, because I have a lot of connections in the theatrical world, that was my dissertation. So it still remains the only study in existence on the actual experience of being famous. So I'm quoted in newspapers and BBC and all sorts of things, and have been for the past 20 years. And so I started a program called Already Famous with Dr. Donna, because I think there is a clamoring for fame. This lusting for likes has to do with wanting to be famous. There are studies that show that when asked, kids say, what do you want to be when you grow up? The old answer was a celebrity. New Lego studies, now they want to be an influencer. They don't know what they're influencing, who or why, but they want to be an influencer. Yeah, so I started Already Famous with Dr. Donna, particularly to help women and girls, because to your point, and this is, I think, what I've been stressing with you, 9-year-old girls are committing suicide. Suicide because of this comparison. I call it dysfunctional comparison syndrome, and it is a killer. And this is where parenting has to step in. So I started Already Famous with Dr. Donna to help women and girls reclaim and cultivate self-confidence, inner worth, and meaning in life, purpose in life. If we have those three things, it's an inoculation against needing external validation between me and online bullying, that I can push back and say no to that. But if I go home and my mother cares what her friend Joni and Alice and, you know, Bobby think about her, there's no way I'm not going to do that too.
Yeah.
So we have to get really serious about parenting. And every, you know, Stephen Sondheim, Kim would love this, but Stephen Sondheim in Into the Woods wrote a song called Children Will Listen. Careful the things you say, children will listen. Careful you the things you do, children will see and learn and grow. We need to tell that to ourselves as parents. We create the soil and the fertilizer for these fellow human beings who are going to grow to be leaders. So I started Already Famous because I want to help daughters and I want to help mothers come back together and understand the importance of that bond. In Native American lineages, even in actually Eastern European Jewish lineages, this matriarchal line, matrilineal line of women is what we need to do for these girls. On Mother's Day, I saw a thing on TikTok. What about me? You know, I'm 28 years old and I have a kid. Why do I have to make it about my mother? Not only should you make it about your mother, you should make it about her mother and her mother and her mother. Because that is when we get a sense of our groundedness, of where we are in the history of mankind. We are of a lineage. And if we can respect that, then we can respect ourselves. And if we don't, we're just sort of like in this vacuum. We can't. We can only respect others to the extent we respect ourselves. We can only love others to the extent to which we love ourselves. That's why it's so important for parents. I'm saying mothers, but fathers are so equally, and I just can only imagine how lucky your kids are to have you. But to have a father, a strong, warm, tender father, is such a godsend to children, to both boys and girls, and particularly for girls, to know who they are and how just adored they are. I had a nickname for my son. I used to call him G all the time. I still call him G, both of them, because that's my name for gift. Hey, G. And I also just want to say for the audience to go look up a poem by Khalil Gibran in The Prophet. It's called On Children. And it says something to the effect of, children come through us, but they're not of us. They're life's longing for life itself. And we need to be the bow that bends as that arrow shoots forth. And we have no business in that tomorrow. But as the arrow loves to fly, so it loves the bow that is stable. So this imagery of a stable bow for the arrows of your children, I think is a good thing to visualize, because that's what they need, a grounded parent who can sit in the fire of their experience and say, I'm on team you.
Team you. Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh. We could talk for hours. We need to talk for hours.
But I do want to say that women and girls can access these inspirational messages and videos on Instagram, Facebook, and on YouTube at Already Famous with Dr. Donna. And my whole point of it is to get to the heart of these women and girls so they can be like Eleanor Criswell and celebrate themselves. And that's my tagline. To all these women and girls, that you are enough and you're already famous in all the ways that really matter. We're not seeking fame, we're seeking relevance. And my goodness, everyone's relevant.
Dr. Donna Rockwell, wow. That was what a great, great message, great way to conclude this. We're going to have a part two where you come back on and we ruminate on a lot of other things. But this was a powerful interview today. I'm just really so moved by everything you've been talking about. I think it's so timely, so needed. And to your point, I think we have so many people in need of this guidance, of this support. And I hope people, especially young girls and their mothers, but also their fathers, their parents, their siblings will reach out and seek that guidance and support of what you're offering. I think there's a lot out there to be gleaned. As you think about what's in store for the future, just a couple minutes here, what's next for you as you kind of develop, you've developed out Already Famous, but where do you see this going? What are your hopes as you kind of move into this next act? What is this, act six for you? I think you're in a few acts going on.
I'm the George Plimpton of the modern day. He's like known for all the jobs he had. All the jobs he had. Well, I'm actually working with a literary agency right now, and we're creating a book proposal on Already Famous as a sort of empowerment for mothers and daughters to figure out how to really embolden each other to be all that we can be. So that book is on the horizon, and I'm really working on the social media. I do videos all the time. I'm on podcasts. I'm going to be on a TMZ show on fame and celebrity. And that's what my future is. I just am always going to be the Norma Ray to help women and girls understand who they are. My upbringing wasn't so easy. I had a tough dad. He wasn't so easy. And I think that I want to make sure that all girls know what nobody was there to tell me. That you are extraordinary, you're a child of God, and you are here to express your love, your passions, and your gifts with the world. So that's what I'll be doing until the day I die.
And we'll stay in touch all the way through, and I can't wait to continue following you. Yes,
thank you so awesome. Much.
Oh, you're most welcome. As we do with all of our guests, you have two questions that you have to answer before you leave.
Chocolate.
Well, if that's what the term humanistic means to you, then we're going to go with it. I think that, So I like that, actually. Chocolate. I think that works great. So the first question is, what does the term humanistic mean to you, to the eminent humanistic psychologist? Breaking it down for the public out there, what does it mean to Dr. Donna?
Humanistic means to remember love.
Concise, clear. Remember love. Awesome.
So you feel it right here.
Right here. Right here in the heart and in the soul. The last question we have that I think you're going to give us a real knockout answer. What are three things, simple, clear things that an individual can do to improve their mental well-being, their physical well-being, or make change in the world?
The first thing people need to do is to have a curiosity and interest in how your mind works, so that you are not at the effect of it, but can actually drive it. The second thing is to understand that society has an effect on us, and there's a corporate capitalism that is programmed to make us feel like we're not enough, so we continue on the purchase hamster wheel. We need to know we are enough, and that this life is a gift to be lived on our own terms. And the third thing that we can do to have better mental health is to embrace the people we love, overlook their shortcomings, and as you said before, in a Martin Buber sense of I, thou, understand that there but by the grace of God go I all the time. So give people a break and give yourself a break, and know you can't love anyone else more than you love yourself. Those three things.
Gosh, so happy you were on today, Donna.
You feel better now.
I feel like I should pay you for therapy, and I didn't even, yeah.
I take Venmo.
Yeah, okay. I'll send it your way. Yeah, look up Dr. Donna on Venmo and at Already Famous. Thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it. Do you have a website or location you want to point people to, just to call that out one more time?
Sure. They can go to alreadyfamousnow.com. which is my new website, or they can just Google Donna Rockwell and they will find me.
And you'll get a host of stuff.
I hope so. I'd like to reach a lot of women and girls and inspire them to love life and embrace it.
Awesome. Well, thank you for being on Saybrook Insights today, Dr. Rockwell. You are a joy, an inspiration, and someone I look up to. Thank you for being here today.
And thank you for Saybrook.
Dr. Rockwell, thank you so much again for your time and the interview. I hope you enjoyed Donna as much as I did. Remember her three major takeaways. Have a curiosity or interest in how your mind works. Number two, understand society has an effect on us. We need to know that we're enough and that our life is a gift, and the life of others is a gift as well. And embrace the people we love, and embrace, yes, their shortcomings, giving people that break and really leaning into those relationships. If you want to see the YouTube version, please visit our Saybrook YouTube page. You know what to do there. And if you'd like to support the podcast, go to Apple iTunes and leave that 5-star rating and review, and subscribe so you can get episodes as they come out. If you're on Spotify, leave that 5-star rating and make sure to follow us. You can, of course, subscribe to us on most major podcast platforms, including Google, Stitcher, Pandora, and others. Remember to check our show notes for information on today's guest, Dr. Donna, including links to websites, books, and the like. For more about our university, go to www.saybrook.edu. Click on Areas of Study at the top of the page and locate the program of your choice to learn more. Or simply Google Saybrook University. All right, everyone, that's it for today. Thank you so much for joining us yet again. Look forward to seeing you next week. Bye-bye.